And good morning to everyone. Our only case this morning is Christensen versus Gale. Justice Papik is recused from this matter. Justice Miller Lerman will be participating on the briefs. With that in mind, Mr. Spray, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Rodgers. I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time, if that's possible. May it please the court, I'm J.L. Spray, appearing on behalf of Mark Christensen and Senator Lydia Brosh, the appellants and the plaintiffs in this case. I'd like to start with what this petition is not. It is not a constitutional amendment. It is not a referendum repealing a statute. It's not a municipal initiative or referendum under Chapter 18 of the statutes. It is not about timeliness of any filing, and this isn't about the number or quality of signatures or the circulation process. This is a challenge under Article 3, Section 2 of the Nebraska Constitution, which, among other things, creates the right of initiative, but also limits the right of initiative. And the people's choice to create the right and also to limit it at the same time are equally important. The first limitation that is unique to the legislative initiative, and this sentence in the Constitution only applies to the legislative initiative. It says, the constitutional limitations as to the scope and subject matter of statutes enacted by the legislature shall apply to those enacted by the initiative. Every single argument that we bring under this complaint goes to Article 3, Section 2, and that sentence or the next one regarding the single subject provision. In Lutcher v. Robinson, Justice Wright, and quoted by everyone in the briefs, very carefully and articulately said in his concurring opinion that the demands that initiative supporters exercise due care and caution appropriate to the significance of their task. And that's what this case is about, are choices that the sponsors made. The sponsors made the choice on how they wrote the initiative, what they put into the initiative. They made the choice about who was going to be the sponsor. They made the choice about how they were going to represent to the public who the sponsor was. All of the ambitious things they try to do in this initiative were choices carefully made by the supporters of and sponsors of the initiative. Another one of those choices was the choice not to fund the initiative. And all of that is subject to the scope and subject matter of the initiative. This is clearly distinguishable from the standard in Chapter 18 governing municipal initiatives, which deals with legislative authority. That's the standard, legislative authority. This is a limitation on legislative authority in Article 3, Section 2. So the case Fremont versus CODIS, which is much cited by the appellees, simply isn't applicable because it's under a different standard and a different position in the Constitution, relates to the statute and not to the Constitution itself. It makes sense that the people would single out the legislative initiative in providing for this limitation because this applies to appropriations. Only the legislature can appropriate money. Therefore, they want to carefully provide for the legislative power to appropriate. Theoretically, the people through initiative couldn't pass a special legislation, such as provide for a single person to be divorced, or to provide for a pool of funds like in the Hayman versus Marsh case, where they were providing money for the Commonwealth victims. Those types of special legislation are subject to the scope and subject matter of legislation, which clearly the people have limited here in their Constitution. I want to go to the single subject issue, but I want to start by addressing what it is exactly that the sponsors do in this initiative. The first section, clearly, they legislate the expansion of eligibility for Medicaid. They expand Medicaid eligibility to people at 138, maybe 133% of poverty. That's a conflict between the ACA and what they're doing here in the initiative. And they legislate eligibility for individuals between the ages of 19 and 65. So this new pool of people will now be eligible for Medicaid that previously weren't. Secondly, they direct the executive to submit to the federal government a state plan sufficient to get approvals and waivers. So they delegate to the executive the authority to make up the state plan, which could contain all kinds of things. It doesn't have to necessarily, but it could include things like criminal penalties. It could include anything that the executive chooses to put into the state plan.
Who would typically create such a state plan?
The legislature has in the past authorized the executive to do this. No one's ever challenged that. But that's what has been done historically. I think that possibly the application of this case would prohibit the legislature from just carte blanche doing that rather than, for instance, adopting the federal act instead of just delegating these ambiguous issues to the executive to do.
So is that a separation of powers issue?
Absolutely. And that goes to the delegation of authority, which is a separation of powers issue. But third, and separate and apart, they command the executive to do what? To take, quote, all action necessary. So they're saying, hey, executive, whatever you have to do to accomplish this, we don't care what it is. You go do it. And that goes to the delegation and separation, but it also is an entirely separate subject. Because now we are interfacing with the federal government without any limitation on that power. And that goes to the issue of delegation, too. If you don't put a limitation on the standards and limitations on what that power you delegate is, you've really created a whole new authority in the executive that never existed before. And so that goes to the second subject. And let me say this. The way this is written, it's a complicated bear. You know, it's hard to get your arms around it. It's very complicated. It incorporates all kinds of complicated concepts and other things. And to figure out, for instance, whether there is in fact an appropriation here or not, because what do? We say, you have to adopt this plan that requires the state to contribute money. Is that an appropriation? I don't think so under our standard for what an appropriation is in Article 3, but it creates the obligation to commit the state to an appropriation. And does that mean that subsequently the legislature is bound to appropriate the money under the initiative? Because, you know, the legislature can't repeal the initiative except by a supermajority, two-thirds vote. So all of a sudden we're putting in law something that will actually cause further litigation, I'm sure.
How long does the initiative last? Does it have any life terminating? 5 years from now, can the legislature repeal it?
I think they can repeal it, but they have to have the supermajority to
always
do it.
50 years from now, they would need a supermajority.
There may be a 3-year limitation. I'm not sure, Your Honor. But it is clear in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2. I know that. Maybe I can come back with that in rebuttal. And then the last thing they do is they bind themselves by this limitation. So they bind the legislature to be obligated to support this, either indefinitely for a period of time. The sponsor's object and their stated object purpose is to expand Medicaid to adults ages 19 through 65, whose incomes are 138% of the federal poverty level. That's what they say the object of the petition is. They accomplish that in the first two sections. So then the question is the command to the executive to take all action necessary to achieve the object of the petition? And we go to the natural necessary connection standard that the court has mostly adopted through the litigation on a single subject. And the definition of necessary, and there's plenty of words defined in these briefs, but not the definition of necessary, which according to Black is, that is needed for some purpose or reason, essential, that must exist or happen and cannot be avoided, it is inevitable.
Don't we have Nebraska case law that defines it a little more broadly than that?
Not in this context, I don't think, Your Honor. I think in Article 3, Section 2, we have to rely on the words in the Constitution. And I think it is essential. Now, counsel cites McCullough versus Maryland, and we get into that necessary and proper in the federal Constitution. Different words, different connection. different applications. So I think the court...
Well, is the second part designed to be a sweetener?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. Maybe it is. But I think the word necessary still has to have some meaning, and it has to be connected and essential to the core purpose. Now, in CODIS in the City of Fremont case, this court determined under Chapter 18 of the statutes in a municipal ordinance that the necessary natural connection was the nexus for E-Verify, that was the key to the case, was that everything came through E-Verify. Well, here the subject of the case, stated by the sponsors again in their own petition, is to adopt the expansion of Medicaid, which they do in the first section, and then to apply to the federal government for funds and then command the executive to do whatever it takes to get those.
Well, let me ask you that question again. Isn't the second part of it designed to sort of alleviate any argument that this is going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money because we're going to get all the money from the federal government?
Well, that's a log-rolling argument, Your Honor, but I think the other piece of it is this. The second section is designed really to confuse the voters and make them believe that. More importantly, you don't need the second section to enact what they want to enact. You can expand Medicaid and just stop. And the state can appropriate or not appropriate. There's no requirement that the state get the money from the federal government. That's the second subject, is that, and we're going to fund this, which you really aren't doing. I hope the court has a chance to examine how the mechanism works. But once you apply and submit your plan necessarily has to include the payment by the state of a sliding scale percentage of money. And so it commits the state by submitting the plan and promising to do this, it commits the state to the expenditure.
In the first in-stream flow appropriation case, which is not cited by either party, albeit addressing a different constitutional provision, defined the word necessary in that context more broadly. Let's assume for the moment that definition from that case applies here equally. What does that do to your argument?
I don't think it does anything, Your Honor, with all due respect. I think the argument is still valid that the state could appropriate all the money to expand Medicaid without any reliance on the federal government at all. They're choosing to do it this way to entice the voter and basically to attract the signers and the voters to the thing, thinking, well, we're not the federal government, so we don't have to pay for it. And that's the second subject.
Without the second subject, it would be all on the state to pay for it or fund it, wouldn't it?
If this constituted an appropriation, it would. I don't think it is an appropriation. That's one of the questions I think the court has to get to is whether this is an appropriation. I don't think it is. I think the appellees don't think it is because it doesn't comply with Article 3, Section 22 and 25. But with the commitment piece of it in there, it may be. And that's a bigger question for the court, not here necessarily. If I bring an initiative that does X and appropriates Y money to do it, are those two different subjects? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think we have to get to that. But clearly there's two subjects here in terms of the federalism issue with the outreach to the federal government and also the act of enlarging or expanding Medicaid.
I want to go back to log rolling and sweetening one more time.
Okay, Your Honor.
What do you think the status of the law in Nebraska is as to whether or not you can log roll or sweeten what you want to accomplish?
I don't think this is the standard the court has adopted in the past, but I think it could be summarized by, if it's simply there to attract voters, it's log rolling. And I think that's what...
Is that forbidden?
Yes. And if the purpose of it is there to confuse voters, this is a part I don't think we have a clear precedent on, but if the purpose is to confuse the voters about the mechanism or the totality of the initiative, the totality of the scope, the totality of the subject matter is so confusing that a voter can't quite figure out what the consequence of it all is, then it should be found to be unconstitutional under the scope and subject matter provision of Article 3, Section 2. Again, it all comes back to that.
And should that be determined now, or later after there is the vote?
Well, I think it should be determined now, and the reason is, I think in terms of a challenge under Article 3, Section 2, we're talking about pre-election issues such as subject matter, resubmission, signatures, validation, and this is right in there with it. I think the people intended that this limitation was to the process, not to the outcome of the process, that this limitation of scope and subject matter in the initiative, the unique provision that only applies to legislative initiatives, that the scope and subject matter should be viewed now before the voters are troubled or have to vote on the issue, just like the other things in Article 3, Section 22. This isn't a big leap, I don't think.
Is it your contention that there's any text or any phrasing of the initiative that is confusing?
Yes, Your Honor. I think both the command to the executive to apply to federal funds and the act, which isn't incorporated into the face of the initiative, would be confusing to the voter because they'd have to go to another resource to figure it out, i.e. the ACA or some type of federal guidance on it. And then I think the executive command to exercise all power necessary to accomplish this is in fact confusing to the voter because it feels so much like an appropriation, but it's not. And what does it really mean? So I think the confusion of the voter is important. And let me just say this in closing, and I'll sit down for now. The issue here is that the sponsors have made these choices on how to present this to the voters. They've done it in a fashion that the legislature wouldn't do. That's the point of Exhibit 3. But it's also pretty clear just on the face of it. And the voters are being given a false choice to vote for something that can't be implemented if it's not an appropriation because the legislature still has to act, or that they are in fact implementing something. And this is the first time this court's ever looked at an initiative like this. There are very few cases on it, but I think it's unique under Article 3, Section 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Berry, good morning to you. How are you going to split your time this morning?
Mr. Post and I have agreed that I'll take the first 15 minutes and leave the final five for him, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Andy Berry. I represent appellees Ensure the Good Life, Sarah Amanda Gershon, Kathy Campbell, and Rowan Zetterman. Under Article 3, Section 2 of our state's constitution, the first power reserved to the people is the initiative, whereby laws may be enacted by the people independently of the legislature. This court has repeatedly held that that right is precious to the people and is one which courts are zealous to preserve to the fullest tenable measure of spirit as well as letter. Rather than preserve the right of initiative, the appellants ask this court to diminish it. The petition contains only one subject, the expansion of Medicaid in Nebraska under the Affordable Care Act. Appellants argue there are two subjects, the expansion of eligibility on the one hand, and then taking advantage of federal Medicaid funding to pay for 90% of the cost of that expansion on the other hand.
Is that in our record?
The 90%? It's part of the law if you look at the ACA.
Is this an appropriation?
No.
Why not?
Because an appropriation is a specific directive from the legislature that authorizes a state officer to take money from the Treasury. This doesn't do that. This is like any other authorizing legislation where the legislature could authorize the construction of a four-lane highway. That might involve both state and federal
money.
Well,
Mr. Spray just made the comment that the legislature could not and would not, if they were going to try to adopt this in the legislature, do it this way. What is your response to that?
I
mean, the legislature would have to appropriate money and figure out how this was going to be paid for.
Right. There are two steps in the legislative process. The first is to authorize the program, and then if that program requires the expenditure money, there's an appropriations process as well to determine how much money is going to be required and spent. That authorizing legislation can be indefinite or certainly extend beyond 2 years. The existing Medicaid program we have is an example of that. Other state projects like roads would be another example. the legislature, every biennium, has to look at it at the state's commitments and decide what's necessary to fund those. That's the appropriations process.
Let's back up a step in the analysis. Can an initiative petition include an appropriation?
I think that it could include an appropriation, but there would be some limits on what, you know, the same limits that would apply to the legislature would apply to the initiative petition.
And the rationale for that answer is what?
I think that the provisions of the Constitution that say that the initiative has to, same scope and subject matter as the legislature would apply to the limits that the legislature has on appropriations as well.
Is there a requirement that appropriations be in a separate bill?
I don't think there's a constitutional requirement, but that's certainly our process, and that's reflected in the rules of the legislature that we've cited in our brief.
If this matter were to pass, would the legislature still have the ability to choose not to appropriate the funds?
That's a separate issue that really isn't addressed in this case. I mean, certainly the legislature would have to look at what the cost would be and make an appropriations decision. It goes beyond the scope of this case.
Do they have to fund it?
What's that?
Do they have to fund the Nebraska portion?
As I said, Your Honor, that hasn't been raised in this case. We've been looking at it on an expedited schedule, so I don't know the answer to that question. My intuition is that, yes, they would have to, but I really haven't looked at
it. And if they don't, we'd be back here again, most likely.
Possibly. There also may be political solutions. But again, we're talking about hypotheticals, which are the reasons why the court doesn't pass on hypothetical questions.
If they don't have the choice not to fund it, wouldn't that make this an appropriation?
If they don't have the choice not to fund it. I don't think that it necessarily would, because there are parts of appropriation that there are questions in appropriations that deal with where is this money going to come from as well, so that the legislature may have different options. So I don't think it would be an appropriation even in that case, simply making a commitment, state commitment to expend funds.
Do we know what this expansion would cost? And is that in our record?
Well, so Exhibit 3 to the record, which was excluded, and I think properly excluded, does include some estimates from the fiscal office of the legislature as to what the cost would be.
Are you arguing that Exhibit 3 should have been part of the record?
No, I'm not. I'm just answering Justice Funk's question that there is some information in the record, but it wasn't admitted, so it's not part of the evidence that we have. I would add on the appropriations issue that I think that issue is, we're arguing about a substantial issue of constitutional law that this court has said isn't part of the question whether something is capable or should be presented to the voters. So I don't think that there's jurisdiction over that issue right now, and I think some of the questions...
It's not ripe?
Right.
When would it become ripe?
Well, it would become ripe if and when the Medicaid expansion petition becomes law in the first place. What's that?
Immediately?
I think it would not become ripe based on some of the questions that we've had unless and until the legislature refused to appropriate the funds. I think that you would certainly have a ripe question at that point in time. But I don't think you have one now. And I'm not sure if there's any point in the interim where that would become right.
What do you think the status of the law in Nebraska is in regard to log rolling?
Well, I think if you look at the Luncher case, the key principle in Luncher is there has to be a lack of a unifying purpose. So, Your Honor, you talked about a sweetener, and certainly that's one way that you could look at federal funding, but a very different way that you could look at federal funding is to say, Medicaid has always been a joint federal and state program. The federal government has always supplied the lion's share of the funds for Medicaid. And if there's going to be an expansion, it has to be paid for some way. And so the Federal Affordable Care Act just provides this. So this is a means of paying for the obligation. And in that sense, it is a necessity. You can't expand Medicaid eligibility without paying for it. And there's a clear unifying purpose, in the words of Luncher, between expanding Medicaid eligibility and the federal funding, because the federal funding is precisely to pay for this expansion. And that's very different than the situation the court was faced with in Luncher. In Luncher, you had a bill that was going to authorize one new form of pari-mutuel gambling, which was historical horse racing, or betting on replayed horse races.
And then they put a sweetener on it.
Right. But I think it's the nature of the sweetener that matters, Your Honor. And so, in Luncher,
Is there some argument that you would have to tell the people in this initiative process that they have to pay for 10% of it?
I don't
think... Or that the legislature will be bound by this, which I think you just said they will be.
Your Honor, just to be clear, I don't know if the legislature will be bound by it or not. That's not a question that's been raised in this petition, and I think in this case, and I think that there are some difficult issues of constitutional law presented there, and probably procedure as well. So I'm not taking a position on that issue.
But we know that federal funds will only cover 90%.
Right.
We know that.
Right. And I think that is clear from the federal law, and we've never had law in this state on the adoption of a ballot initiative that says that all of the consequences of the initiative need to be clearly spelled out in the petition itself. That's something for the debate. That's something we leave to the people of Nebraska, just as in the Nebraska legislature when LB 441 was...
Well, but isn't that what is partially behind the concept of log rolling, the idea of sweeteners or confusing the public about what they are signing for?
That is true. If they don't understand that these provisions of the bill would go together, Your Honor. I agree with that. But I don't think that there's confusion here at all. I mean, as Justice Funk said, the federal law is clear. It pays for 90% of this. There's no danger that the people are going to be deceived into thinking the federal government is going to pick up the entire tab. Or concerns about that, I don't think really have any place. We rely on the democratic process, and we trust the people to evaluate the facts and the law and make a decision, just as we would trust the legislature. And just to come back to Luncher, because I want to make sure I fully answered your question. In the Luncher case, not only were revenues from historical horse racing going to be taken and appropriated, but other gambling revenue was also going to be taken and appropriated for purposes which had nothing to do with historical horse racing. It was education and property tax. And so the type of sweetener that the court was concerned about in Luncher was, you know, we're going to pay for these other things that you like, people, if you'll give us this thing. They were different. That's not the situation here. The federal funding is precisely to pay for the expansion of Medicaid. That's all it's for. And it won't go beyond that, as Justice Funk has pointed out. It's 90% of it. So there's not going to be extra money applied to extra programs that don't have anything to do with Medicaid expansion. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To what extent do you contend that the federal law, the ACA in particular, commits the federal government indefinitely to pay 90%?
That's what the law says. It's an indefinite commitment under that law.
Could Congress change that?
Congress could change that law. That it could.
That goes back to Mr. Spray's argument about the supermajority required of the legislature to change something, which I've now looked and does not have a time limitation. Isn't that a possible issue, that a future legislature that has been affected by a decrease in Congress's will to fund the ACA may be trapped by that supermajority?
Well, it's certainly an issue that a future legislature would have a supermajority requirement. I guess I'd say two things. First of all, that's just part of the structure that we have in our Constitution. And I think while that may inform the content of some of the rules around the initiative, I think this measure clearly meets the single subject test as it's been articulated by this court. Second, if it's really that big of a loss of federal funding, I don't think you'd have any trouble getting two-thirds of the legislature to fix the problem. They'd recognize that this is a serious problem that has to be addressed.
Your opponents are focusing on two sentences in the Constitution. The log rolling issue that we've been talking about, does that fall under the first one about scope and subject matter, or the second one about only one subject, or is it both?
I think it falls under the second one. I think if you read the Luncher case, the court distinguished the scope and subject matter, and then it adopted a single subject rule, and in contrast to what my opposing counsel has been saying, they adopted that test expressly from the single subject test that governs municipal ordinances. So the City of Fremont case is relevant law. The Lunch v. Tusa is relevant law. They really are the guiding precedents of this court on what the single subject rule means. And we come back to the natural and necessary connection test. And if you think about those cases, you know, in the City of Fremont, there were multiple things that related to the concept of immigration. Any one of them could have been omitted. Not any single one of them was absolutely essential. The people were allowed to vote on that because it all dealt with the same general subject matter.
There is, of course, a danger of what level of that you look at the subject from as to that you could eviscerate the single subject rule by looking at it from 10,000 feet.
And that's true, Your Honor, but here what we have is a measure that will expand Medicaid under the Federal Affordable Care Act. I mean, that's clear from the text of the measure that the court has before it. And as I think we've explained in our briefs and today, expanding eligibility and the federal funding, those go hand in hand under the Affordable Care Act. They go hand in hand as a matter of common sense because expanded eligibility has to be paid for. I'm running out of time, so I'd like to say just a couple of closing remarks.
Does the wording of how you put the funding part of it, part two, on the initiative make a difference?
How does the wording make a difference?
Yes. Assuming you've carefully worded this.
I don't think I understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, can you be too careful in the way that you worded it?
Too careful to do what?
Well, for example, you certainly don't get into all of the details that we've talked about today of 90% of this is funded by the ACA and all of the details of ACA. You obviously couldn't put that in an initiative, but make a kind of general command that you will do all things necessary, executive.
And I think this gets to my final point. I don't think it's not a general command to do all things necessary in a vacuum. It's to do all things necessary to maximize federal funding under the ACA. And so we have federal standards in that act that define what that is. So that's a separation of powers argument that I don't think this court has jurisdiction over and doesn't really go anywhere. But I guess I'd like to come back to where we began, and that is the power of initiative is the first power that's reserved to the people. And under our Constitution, the people are co-equal with the legislature. Mr. Spray may think Medicaid expansion is a bad idea as a policy matter. Members of the court may think it's a bad idea as a policy matter. Some voters in Nebraska may think it's a bad idea as a policy matter. A majority may. But on the other hand, they may not. The point is that under our Constitution, if the people are going to be co-equal with the legislature, it's their role to decide. It's their role to decide whether they agree with appellants' arguments against expansion or whether they think it makes sense. And everybody here has to concede that the legislature would have the power to do this. In our state, the people do as well. So we think the district court properly refused to revoke or diminish that power of the people, the role that the people in Nebraska have in legislating under our state constitution. And on behalf of my clients and all those who signed the petition, we would ask you to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Post, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm going to just begin by answering some of the questions that were just asked. I think that would be the most helpful for the court at this time. First question from Chief Justice Hevekin. In Article 3, Section 2, as Justice Castle just noted, the very last sentence does reference when and how the legislature can repeal, amend, or modify an initiative. It can be at any time, but it has to be the supermajority. And for the next question that was asked, whether or not attracting voters and confusing voters are the same thing, it would be the Secretary of State's position that those are two different things. At least under this court's precedence, the confusing voters would fit within that log rolling that the court has concern with and the Constitution has concern with, but simply attracting voters with a provision would not be log rolling, which then transitions to Justice Castle's question concerning...
Where do you get authority for that statement?
This court's precedents haven't gone that far. I'm not aware of a case that says simply having an attractive measure fits within the definition of log rolling and violates a single subject rule. And that kind of transitions to Justice Castle's question related to the scope and subject, and I think that the case you want to look at there would be the Brandt case, and I can't remember offhand if they actually used the words scope and subject in that case, but if you remember, that's the case where the initiative was basically an expression of popular opinion, and at that point, single subject did come up, but the court was very much concerned with, is this the sort of thing that the legislature could enact in statute, even if they wanted to, and the court said no. On the appropriations questions, an example of an appropriation would be like an A bill that's attached to a legislative bill in the legislature, and it usually begins with the phrase, there is hereby appropriated X dollars from X fund for this purpose. That's going to be an example of an appropriation. We don't have that here. The question that Justice Castle asked related to the limitations on an appropriation in Article 3, Section 22, those limitations about how it has to be in a separate bill, that only applies to appropriations related to the pay of the members and officers of the legislature, as well as salaries of the officers of the government. And it's my understanding that this particular initiative is not going to relate in any way to the text that we're looking at right now relates to paying any salaries at all.
So could the legislature not fund their 10% portion?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think the legislature has...
How is this not an appropriation?
I do believe the legislature has the ability to consider the needs of the state as they appropriate the dollars. And so I think a slight variation of the question would be, what if they don't fund it fully? What if they fund 90% of their obligation or something like that? Because, if I may finish.
You may.
Because they need to balance the budget for whatever reason. I think the legislature could do that. Now, we might have issues on the other side of the equation if someone is denied Medicaid that believes they're eligible for Medicaid under the statute, and then this court might face that question. But as far as the legislature's power, this text does not obligate them to fund this. It would be up to the legislature to make that decision. I don't know that it would be likely. If this measure were to pass, you'd have an expression of the opinion of the state, and that might weigh on the minds of many legislatures as they make that decision. But I don't know that they would be required under the words you see in front of you to fund this, or at least fund it fully. If there are no other questions, we would ask the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
3 minutes
and 26 seconds, Mr. Spray.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Going directly to that question of funding, if this isn't an appropriation, then the scope is incomplete. If it is an appropriation, the scope and subject matter is too broad, and it violates the single subject rule. And going to Justice Castle's question about the Congress and whether it's bound or not by this, of course it's not. The proposition is that one legislature can't bind the next. Both the Congress and the Nebraska legislature reconstitute every 2 years, and that new legislative body can do as it pleases with regard to any legislation, including laws already passed, and the prerogative is still there, regardless of this, except for the binding effect this has on the executive and on the Nebraska legislature through the unlimited amount of time that it has to repeal it by a supermajority. This does have significant consequences, and those consequences are the responsibility of the sponsors who chose to write this the way they did as an incomplete act. I think the funding mechanism is critical. We've heard discussion today. I don't think there's a real answer to whether this is an appropriation or not. That's a serious consideration to whether the scope of this is sufficient, constitutionally sufficient, under Article 3, Section 2, as it applies to only initiative petitions, the scope and sufficiency of the act that's being enacted.
Can the legislature both authorize and appropriate money for a program in the same bill?
They don't.
Well, I know they don't. But can they, other than with respect to the payment of constitutional officers?
I think it's Article 3, Section 22, it may be 25, but it provides the process as well as the necessity for component parts of an appropriation. And it has to be separate, certain, so you have to have a dollar sign attached to it. There's a lot of things you have to do to satisfy the Constitution relative to a legislative appropriation. And the legislative appropriation is the first step, and then the second step is that the officer who's the beneficiary of the appropriation submits a warrant to the treasurer, and only the treasurer, pursuant to that process, can actually pay a bill, send a check.
Isn't that a substantive issue, though?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it goes to the requirement that the scope and subject matter of the petition has to be sufficient. It has to be complete, both not too big and not too small. And I, going to Ms. Justice Havokin's question about the application of the two sentences, I think they both apply to this. Article 3, Section 2, the sentence dealing with scope and subject matter, goes to this issue as well as the single subject issue. They're both in play, they're both live, and this addresses or implicates both of them, and they should be addressed. We haven't had a chance to talk about the sworn statement at all. I want to just make the distinction here for the court. And I know sometimes these precise little pieces can hang up an initiative, but the difference between this and the Hargesheimer decision a couple years ago is that in Hargesheimer, the issue was you have to list all the sponsors, everybody who woke up in the morning and think, gee, this is a good idea. You have to list them all. Go find them and list them. This is a case where the actual sponsor concealed their identity from the public by using their service mark or ballot question committee. Call it whatever you want. So, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.